Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Kyle and Patrick's Still Unnamed Podcast. I'm Patrick McEwen, also known as the Lacrosse Film Guy, joined here once again by Inside Lacrosse Gear and Lifestyle editor Kyle Devitt. How's it going, Kyle?
That's right, guys. We're alive. We're back.
We are. It's been a while.
We survived.
It's been a while.
There's a lost podcast somewhere that was pretty good, but didn't come together.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That is one of the reasons. But anyways, the big thing that I wanted to start off talking about is my article about secondary assists in the NLL, which
yes.
I was proud of. I completed, this actually may be a good question to ask this, I completed what I'm calling the IL trifecta, in which I now have written articles for Inside Lacrosse, like as in the sort of like men's field section, IL women and IL indoor.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I've written an indoor article, so you actually beat me.
And I'm not sure how many people who regularly write for IL have written for IL women, or vice versa, how many IL women writers have ever written anything for the, like, about men's field lacrosse.
I don't want to say got stuck. I'm going to say I was assigned the women's semifinal 2 years ago, Northwestern Maryland. So I did write that.
But anyways, I highly recommend you go read that article. That I think it is, it's one of the more important things I've ever done with stats, because I think it's aimed at addressing what I think is a sort of more important question from lacrosse analytics of, is a certain stat important? And if so, sort of how important is it? Rather than merely kind of assigning numbers to things that we already think or know are good. And sort of evaluating just who was good this past season, or who's good this season, based on some statistic that you're not used to looking at.
Right.
And I guess the basic summary, what I did is I looked at secondary assists, and I borrowed a technique that has been used in hockey analytics, where you look at, for my piece, I looked at NLL forwards who had played more than 10 games in back-to-back seasons, to kind of give you a consistent sampling of players. And I looked at how consistent were their goals per game in primary assists and secondary assists and at even strength. So in 5-on-5 situations. And what you'll find when you do that is that the year-to-year correlations for goals per game and primary assists are pretty decent. So guys who score more goals per game and have more primary assists per game tend to have more of those same stats the next season. However, that's not true of secondary assists. And I think the interpretation from that is that secondary assists end up relying a lot more on luck than they do on skill. And that's a conclusion that people have reached in hockey as well. So I know you read it because you tweeted about it this morning, but do you have any reaction to the piece, Kyle?
So I think one of my main, I had two main reactions. One was, if you're comparing box to hockey, scores in box, general box scores have more goals in indoor than hockey, correct?
Yes, by far, so, like a factor of 5 or more.
Right. So do you think that had any impact on the final findings?
No, because, well, so my analysis, when I kind of compared it to hockey, but it was more just I wanted to give credit to the guys who had done that analysis for hockey, and essentially I was copying their technique.
Right.
And I would say the reasons where it matters are, so for the hockey analysis, they're lucky enough to have, ice time statistics. So they can look at not just, like, how many goals per game a player had, but they can tell you, like, Sidney Crosby averaged 20 minutes and 38 seconds of ice time per game. So we know he played, you know, X number of minutes per season. And, you know, Alexander Ovechkin averaged, you know, 21 minutes and 25 seconds of ice time per game. So we know they knew it. They can finally tune that to look at goals or assists per minute. Or per 60 minutes, and right. I with the NLL, I only had per game. But the other difference is the NHL plays 82 games, and in the NHL they're only playing 18. So in some ways, the higher number of goals per game just offset the far fewer number of games, so that you are looking at roughly equivalent sample sizes per season.
Okay. All right. So that was my one takeaway, is how do the amount of goals correlate? And my second takeaway was, do you think that this stat is different, secondary assists, if you kept track of it in field? Do you feel personally, given the data that you have for these two things, can you come up with a hypothesis about the impact of secondary assists in field lacrosse based on this and your knowledge of field lacrosse?
Yeah, so I guess I think the important distinction, and it's something that I think a lot of people miss, especially like when they in field lacrosse, it's not uncommon to hear people or coaches talking about the importance of hockey assists. But the weird thing is, when they say hockey assists, they really don't mean hockey assists, because hockey and box lacrosse, they give out assists to anybody who touched the ball before the goal scorer. Whereas in field lacrosse, you use basketball-style assists, where it's sort of only if that pass created the goal do you give a primary assist, or just an assist at all. And so a lot of people, I think, when they talk about hockey assists in field lacrosse, what they mean is not a hockey assist, but a second basketball assist, if that makes sense. Right. And so...
Sure.
I think, so in a way, it inherently sort of has to be more important, because you're only recording the stat when you think it's important. When it's the guy who draws the slide that creates the goal, or when a guy keeps moving the ball. So I think odds are that there is a more likely chance that they would be meaningful. There'd just be less noise in the situation, like in the data. There's less randomness, less luck, because in a lot of situations in like the NHL or in hockey, that second pass before the goal has nothing to do with the way the goal is created. It might just be a pass around the perimeter to the next guy so that he can, you know, go into a pick and roll or something.
Well, don't you think that's still helping to create? Because you're making the pass.
Right, and I think that's the other tricky thing for people to sort of understand about the analysis and the data, is it's not that the goal would have been scored without that pass. It's sort of a question of how important is that stat in terms of separating the talent and ability of lacrosse players. Like, everybody who plays forward in the NHL is a much better lacrosse player than I am. Fair?
Okay.
It's just a question of, is the best... do second assists help you differentiate the best NHL forward from the worst? And that's where the answer is no, because there's so much noise in the data that so many of them are luck that it's not helpful, because skill sort of doesn't come through. That being more skilled doesn't help you accumulate more secondary assists as much as just being lucky does.
Well, into the... the point is actually a little different, relating from box to field, in the sense that it's much harder to score in the NHL than it is in NCAA or MLL, just in terms of finishing the ball, right? And that holds the same in hockey, which is why you kind of use hockey as your baseline here, right?
Right.
So, in essence, the stat completely changes when it's applied to a larger field and a larger goal. Would you say that's fair?
Maybe. I don't know. That's a good question. It's one that I would love to have the data to be able to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just my takeaway from this, for that, is more... just because you think something is important and it looks important doesn't necessarily mean that it actually is.
Sure. Sure.
And I think there's sort of also, what I was trying to get at too, is there's a difference between, it may be important in the sense that the goal wouldn't have been scored without it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it was an important part of, or that relative to all of the other things that went into creating that goal, it was very important.
So my kind of new take on this, just hearing you talk about it, I would be interested in applying this in a different way and using it to evaluate units of players as opposed to individual players. So I feel as if you had this metric for second assists and you had it and you could measure playing time, let's put that in there for NCAA as well, even though they don't really do that either, but except for goalies. So we have this stat of second assists per unit with an attack unit. So how many second assists were created just between that unit or just between the starting six of a certain group? That would tell me a lot about key players in an offense, more so than it would tell me about key players in the NLL.
Well, what it might tell you about their role in the offense. But right. I think the question... Huh?
Right, that's what I'm getting at. Sure.
Right, I guess that's sort of... That's a different question, I guess, than sort of what I was looking at. And I think... Whereas, and I guess it also, one of the examples that I would sort of use that, like, on it is to talk about secondary, even, like, the created hockey assists in field lacrosse is, remember the Syracuse offense that went to the national championship, where you had Kevin right. Rice and, which Maltz brother, I want to say, is it Derek? Yes, with Derek Maltz, Dylan Donahue at attack, and JoJo Marasco, Luke Cometti, and Scott Loy in midfield. Do you remember that one mm-hmm. that I'm talking about?
Yes.
Scott Loy picked up all kinds of hockey assists in that offense. Because
right.
JoJo Marasco would draw the pole, and he would have a short stick. And he was a big, fast guy who could pretty easily draw slides against most short sticks. But rather than sort of his first option almost wasn't looking to score or looking to feed a goal scorer. It was either to move it to Kevin Rice at X or roll back and move it to JoJo Marasco up top and let them create the goal. And so I would look at that accumulating a bunch of secondary assists in that offense that tell you a lot about his role, but I'm not sure how much did that tell you that he was a great lacrosse player.
Well, it tells you about his understanding of his role, which if you have him play that role at a level that's comparable or a competition that's comparable, you would expect a similar outcome, right?
I guess, I don't know. It's, I think those are questions that are worth looking into, but I'm not confident that I really know the answer. I guess that's what I'm saying is I think the one part aspect of that I think that the analysis of the NLL leads me to believe is going where I went with that I think you shouldn't look at the secondary assist as valuable as the primary assist.
Right.
And I think there is a chance in field lacrosse that it is valuable because it just indicates how it correlates with an ability to draw slides.
Right.
Which I think is undoubtedly valuable and a skill. Not everybody can do it, all the time or against as many defenders. But I'm not totally sure that secondary assist number necessarily indicates that a guy is a good sign that someone's a better lacrosse player in the same way that more goals or more primary assists does.
Right. So I think to the same degree. What the other part of this too is the reaction to this article, which is. You know, something we'll get into a little later is people's reaction to you in general is applied to this article, where people just automatically assume you're attacking something and not approaching it with a inquisitive mind.
Oh, yeah. No,
and I think that came out bad for you.
That's a huge problem that I have on Twitter.
Yeah.
If you know how to fix that, you should really tell me.
I mean, I'm the last person you need to ask about fixing anything on Twitter. let's
That's
be
true.
Real. You
That's
took
true.
You take so much heat off of me. Do you know who was getting your heat before you? Me. Like, I was the guy who was getting, you know, players coming after them and chirping and all that stuff. And that still happens to a certain degree. But, man, you have really taken the belt. Like, you have, like, the haterade belt. And you are Vince McMahon and Conor McGregor strutting through the stadium, man.
I guess so. But I feel like there's a lot of... There's a lot of, like, players that I think... Or when people... I think that's the other thing, too, that people interpret as, like, heat or, like, oh, they're calling you out. That are people that, like, I am very comfortable having a discussion with and disagreeing.
Sure.
That, and it's not, just because you don't agree with something about it, so with about something with somebody doesn't mean that it's a big deal.
Sure.
I think it's, to me, going, and this is something that goes back to, that I tweet about it occasionally, I think some people, but I was a relatively successful high school debater. And so, right. To me, disagreeing about something and then, like, you know, immediately, like, after the discussion's over, hanging out with somebody and not having it be personal at all and not, you know, being angry at them is very natural and very easy for me to do. And I think sometimes it's something other people struggle with, and I think it's sometimes when they see me, like, arguing with somebody, they think it's a lot more heated and personal than it actually is.
Right, well, again, this is a perfect example of how I am totally different from you. And it's mostly because I spent my whole life working myself up into kind of like a lather to get to a competitive place in everything. So it's not just sports. As I get older, it's much easier to get into the headspace you're talking about. But, I mean... I'm like the meanest dude ever on a field, like or a court, like anything like that. When we're competing, it's bad. And sometimes I hold grudges. Like, that's no joke. Like, that's just kind of my personality. Is I'm very intense, and sometimes I can't turn it off. And you're like the opposite, where I've very rarely seen you actually angry. I think but at the same time, like, that's not the defining characteristic of you, right?
No,
like,
not at all.
A lot of people's defining characteristic of me is, well, he's the angry MLO guy. Like, he gets pissed. He gets angry. He, like, rants. He freaks out. And that's – people see that as anger. But for me, that's just how I express my passion for things, is with a high volume. I can be very loud. I can be very confrontational. And I can be very provocative. So – those are kind of things that you're doing in a different way, where your volume necessarily in person is different than your volume comes across on Twitter. And I think people have a problem with that. And I've had this discussion before. Person versus persona is very different. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think I've ever told you this. Before I met you, I hated your guts. I did. Because I didn't like how you talked. I didn't like how you talk to people, because I think that it comes across a certain way that when you have a personality like mine, which is very forceful, you kind of want to, like, force that person to have your point of view sometimes. Or you want to just, like, shake them and be like, why don't you understand what I'm saying? I don't care what you're saying. And there's a lot of that on the internet, and there's a lot of that on lacrosse Twitter, and I think all of us need to learn to not do that as much. But I think that's kind of the issue people have with you and points like this and articles like this that are super the insight that you're presenting here is completely different from how people look at lacrosse, and it's coming across in other sports, basketball, even football, soccer, even where, you know, statistics are getting, you know, they have the Sloan Conference every year. That's a big deal. Statistics are how, you know, and metrics are how things are measured, and worth of players versus worth of name of player is such a hot topic in sports that it comes across strange when you talk about it, because no one else talks about it. It's the same way that when I talk about MLL, like, you know, Jim Rome or Bill Simmons talks about basketball or football. And it's I have this viewpoint, and this is why I see this, because my eyes tell me this, and my brain tells me this, and my eyes and my brain are different than yours, and you can agree with it or not. You have a different tact to that. You have numbers. So my whole analysis is more based on intuition and experience and looking at things and applying them, and you're using actual data. You're not using eye test, even though you do eye tests as well. I've been side by side with you evaluating players, and people would be shocked to see that, like, you and I agree on basically everybody when we watch them from completely different perspectives.
Yeah, well, when it comes to, like, watching players, I don't necessarily think – I'd say I think about sort of the game in general differently than you do. But in terms of watching players, I would say that it's an empirical fact that you and I have sat and watched, like, games of high school players and thought the same players were good for the same reasons without, you know.
Sure.
So that's definitely, that, you know, that's true. But I also just say one thing, I've got sort of going back to what you said about on Twitter, is I think you're definitely right. And I think if people, the lack of voice and tone inflection, I think that you see on Twitter probably is part of the problem. That I think a number of people like will tell me to, like, chill, which I always think is funny, right? Because to me, whatever we were discussing about just wasn't a big deal. And, like, yeah, I disagreed with somebody about it, but, like, I really didn't care that much.
Right.
And I am not, despite the fact that I aggressively disagree with people, and I'm not shy at pointing that out, it doesn't mean that I am angry or particularly intense about the discussion.
You're not an aggressive person at all. Would you say you're not an aggressive person? Because I would say that.
Yeah. No, that's why I was a terrible football player. So my dad, it was one of my dad's theories about why certain kids, like, that I played football growing up with are good is, like, or is that, you know, I mean, that kid's a good football player. He just really enjoys hurting people. And that was never me. But where you're going sort of with the stats discussion, no, I think it's definitely true. And it is something that I've sort of been talking about on Twitter, tweeted a couple times recently, that I think is worth reiterating here, is that I sort of look at, there's sort of, I think, two approaches to sports analytics in general. And one of them is that I sort of describe it as somebody will say, you know, I think X is good, so I'm going to count all the times that a player does X. And whoever does it the most, that will be, you know, that will let me know that they're one of the best players.
Okay.
And I think that approach, well, it's nice, and it's a great way to get data, to sort of explore things, is relatively limited. But I think sort of the real, where sports analytics has a real ton of value is in approaching things like the way, like, I think the secondary assist and article that I wrote did, where you're sort of testing an idea and you're able to conclusively say to somebody, you know, what you thought was important is either more important than you thought, maybe, or less important, or in this case, potentially not important at all. And it sort of adjusts the way that people go about the strategy of the game and how they coach or play or think about the game. If that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, it does. It's just, you have to, and you do realize this. I'm not, like, saying you have to realize this, but you should. I mean, you know this, that when you're a young sport, the resistance to that is going to be there no matter what. Just like it is in mainstream sports, but even more so in, you know, let's face facts. Lacrosse is a niche sport. You know, we're like a fourth tier sport. And anyone that tells you different is lying.
I think potentially more the struggle of that is just there's fewer people in sort of the lacrosse analytics community to either read, like, something that I wrote and either go, oh my gosh, yes, he's right, or, I don't know about that, like, here's, you know, X, Y, and Z that he did wrong that I think, you know, or that I have issues with that if they could be addressed would be more convincing to me. That sure. That in other sports where you have sort of a bigger analytics community, are much easier, you sort of have more of a chamber of discussion. And then whenever, you know, if everybody in that community agrees about something, then sort of somebody like you who's paying attention but sort of outside of that community can just, can acknowledge it, be like, hey, all these analytics guys think this, so it's probably true.
Yeah, well, it's also, so let me ask you a question, though. And this was the best point I saw, not against your point, but sort of challenging your point a little bit. Who had the most second assists?
In this past season, it was Corey Small.
Who was number two?
I have to go look at that. I don't have the numbers up, but it was, I want to say it was Sean Evans. I think Curtis Dixon was number three. I think they had 26, okay. 24, and 23 second assists.
Are those three players three of the top seven players in the NLL?
That's a question for somebody else.
I feel like they are. So, I know Sean Evans is, and I know Curtis Dixon is.
That was my thought. It's Sean Evans for sure. Curtis Dixon, if he's not in the top seven, he's probably top 10.
Yeah.
And Corey Small, I am less confident that he's up there, but is a good, he's finished, he's like top 20 in points last year. So, but I think that's kind of, some of that though is, like Sean Evans gets a ton of assists on the man up.
Yeah.
And I think that is potentially more about opportunity. Which is in some ways tied to ability, that the reason he gets those opportunities is because of his ability.
One of the things I have an issue with too is you use the word luck here.
Right.
And as a statistician, I don't know that you using luck adds to your argument, right?
I could just use randomness. Every time I was trying to be a better writer and use a synonym I would equate luck to just random chance.
Okay. Well, it's not random chance that you're on the man up, right? Like on the field is you earn, like, I'm not, this is what I think people have a problem processing. This is that, when you say things to qualify, this player kind of lucked into this second assist because he's on the man up, or he's on this team that likes that Kiesel out of transition or something.
It's a lot easier to get man up second assists if you're on the man up as opposed to not being on the man up.
Correct. That's more an issue of opportunity and then skill is what you're saying.
Well, and I think that's a more
compelling argument than saying impact of it is lessened, right?
But in terms of the impact, a goal is a goal. So
right,
how important the secondary assist is to that goal doesn't change the value of the goal. And then really arguing that secondary assists are less valuable means that the goal is more valuable, or the goal scoring part of it is more valuable.
Wouldn't you think that man up, or sorry, EMO assists or power play, however you want to say, over box, wouldn't you think that secondary assist is more valuable on the extra man, even though the opportunity is there?
It's more valuable. That and it is potentially true, but the problem is I don't have a data set to control for man up opportunity. That I don't know from game to game who's on the man up for any given team.
Okay.
And so there's just problems, like, for example, when the Swarm, like Miles Thompson last year in 2015 was on the Swarm man up, and in 2016 he wasn't. So there, like, I can isolate that just because his power play goals went from like 8 down to 0 or 1.
Right.
And there's 5 guys who scored a bunch more power play goals than he did in 2016. So it's pretty obvious what happened. But there's it's quantitatively it's difficult. Like there isn't the data set to account for that across the entire league.
Right, and that's, you know, this is obviously I'm spiraling this out into other conversations and giving a different perspective to it.
That is something that would be worth looking into is how consistent are players. You'd have to look at, we're showing our field bias though by calling it man up instead of power play, power play second assist per opportunity, like per power play. Would be looking at how consistent those are would certainly be a worthwhile thing to do.
Yeah,
but I'll say,
and I think the pass matters more. That would be my contention. That would be my hypothesis. Sorry, not contention.
Right, but it's a question. But the primary assist. But I would still say though that's the difficulty thing about analyzing that though is teams are much more likely to run like scripted plays on power plays than they are in even situations.
Oh, absolutely.
And so then it becomes the problem of, is that guy scoring a bunch of goals because he's a better shooter or because you're calling plays for him? And there's
right, and this is what I was getting at earlier.
You're calling plays for him because he's your best shooter.
Right. That's kind of what I was hinting at earlier is role versus execution. And I think this particular stat is more useful as a role measurement than a qualitative measurement, which I think is what you're saying.
No, even in the NLL. No, because if role and opportunity would create more correlation. So the fact that I wrote about this a bunch, mentioned this several times in the piece, that you have to, if you really want to look at ability, you have to control for opportunity. And it's something that we haven't necessarily, we don't have the stats to do a very good job of doing that in lacrosse yet. At any level, indoor or outdoor. And so, if anything, like, it's one of those things that where had secondary assists been slightly correlated or slightly more correlated, it could have been the result of opportunity and role. But that's what's so definitive about the numbers is that there was no correlation to speak of. And so even that really doesn't impact it.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, and I think that you get why people don't get what you're saying. Which is
for sure. That's why we've now talked about this for like 35 minutes.
Right. Right. Well, you have one other point to make, right? Like the 90 second.
Yeah, I just wanted to say
the women's clock.
It's kind of tied into the analytics discussion, and it's something I realized this past weekend when this article hit Twitter, was that we have a really unique opportunity. For people who want a 90-second possession clock in men's field lacrosse to get some data sort of on the impact of that because of the change they're adding it to the women's game.
Right.
And so I think that it is both important for the women's game in itself for there to be a better understanding of possessions and how the shot clock changed things. And just in general, because it's possessions are sort of the lifeblood of all advanced stats in lacrosse in general. But I think also people involved in the men's game have a vested interest in work on those type of stats to see, you know, how many possessions per game more are there in the women's game now that there's a 90-second shot clock than there was in 2016. Or how many more
but
will there
how
be
do you adjust for the extra player?
You don't, I'm not saying it's not perfect. But I think it is, it's just something to pay attention to that you nowhere else do you have such a similar, it's not perfect and it's not exactly the same, but it is similar enough that I think people would be smart to be paying attention to it.
Okay, I'm going to do a troll job here a little bit, not of women's lacrosse, but don't we already have the sample size we need from, and this is, again, this is a troll comment. I understand what I'm doing. Don't we already have that data from MLL? Can't we already do that?
I think that's the other piece of the puzzle. Well, and just because the MLL is playing doesn't necessarily mean that we have all the data we would like to have. But I think it's more important you're looking at the change. When did the MLL... Has the MLL always had a shot clock?
Yes.
So that then you don't, because what I'm talking about is from the 2016 to 2017 changes provide a useful metric into, or a useful look into how the men's college game might change as the result of adding the shot clock. Before we get too far away from talking about you being frothy and ranting and being angry about things, you had some thoughts that you wanted to make about gear and specifically performance mesh.
Okay, so I kind of had a little meltdown Saturday night. I'm not even going to say what head it was. I was stringing a head with a certain mesh. And I was trying to replicate a pocket that I have on another head that we'll talk about later. And it took me hours of switching mesh, switching patterns. Because, all right, here's a little kind of primer for this. If you're not like a stringing person, the sidewall is the most important part of your stick. Everyone used to think it was the whole package, but really the sidewall is where you form your pocket and your stick is created. Your feel is created. Shooters help, but with modern stringing techniques, the sidewall is everything. Okay?
Yes. I agree.
So
there should be no discussion about that.
Right. So with that in mind, this head I'm using has a similar bottom rail offset, right? And this is another point that I wanted to make to, if you're kind of a layman and not like a huge gearhead, the most simplistic way to put this is wherever your pocket is going to function the best, you'll get the most out of your stick if you put your pocket at the point on the bottom rail where it is lowest from the point on the shaft. So
yes, furthest from like the imaginary center line of the axis of the shaft.
Yes. Yes. So basically what that means is the point of offset on the bottom rail, it usually correlates to the top rail because they're symmetrical in most designs, is where your benefit of feel and control of force on the ball is met, right?
Which it maximizes the offset. That having like a maximum legal offset on the head doesn't do you any good if you don't put the ball, if you don't string the pocket such that the ball sits at the point where it is maximally offset.
Right. I mean, it does you good. Some people like doing that. I'm not saying that like you're wrong if you don't do that, but logically, if you're building a pocket, you want that pocket to be concentrated at its deepest point, at the point on the stick where it is the lowest in the offset. And right. For me, that means that I want a middle pocket with a, and the head has to be a middle offset. Okay, which a lot of heads are. And I strung this head with three different kinds of mesh, and I can't even tell you how many different patterns on the sidewall. And one of my rants, I just want to like touch on this. Performance mesh has its own kind of market now. You know, there are all these specialty companies that have popped up of people making mesh. You know, obviously East Coast Dyes, Throne, String King are kind of the top three. Other company, you know, STX has created their own memory mesh, things like that. The problem with all these meshes, as opposed to what we had before, so this is kind of like an old timer rant, is like every mesh before was equally crappy, right? The quality wasn't great, right? But it was equal, okay? Like your sidewall, your diamonds in your hard mesh, okay? The diamonds in the hard mesh were the same on almost every company's generic output of hard mesh. And a piece mesh was like $3 to $5.
My assumption was always like 10. It was like the same factory in China that made all of them.
Correct.
So it didn't matter because nobody. It was just this is mesh. No one even knew what brand it was.
Right. Everybody had the same... The struggle was real for everybody in the same way, stringing ahead before all these new companies popped up that made their own mesh of their own, you know, change the weave, change the material, wax the mesh, do things like that. And the problem with that, and kind of like my resistance to that, even though I am a fairly, I'm not a great stringer by any means, I would say I'm an above average one, but the problem with that is like learning all these modern techniques and applying it to all these different meshes is so different. And the mesh, I'm going to say this, the mesh quality and consistency from company to company varies so vastly that it is to the point of absurdity. I'm just going to say it. It's
Do you mean varies like within the mesh, like within one company's mesh, the quality of each piece varies, or the quality in between from one company's mesh to another?
I'm going to say yes to both of those.
Okay.
Even though that sounds impossible, it's possible. I have gotten different pieces of what is supposed to be the same mesh and had them perform at completely different levels, shall we say, with the exact same string pattern and the exact same head. And that is a problem because modern stringers are everywhere selling you on, I'm going to string this pocket and you can transfer this pocket and this pattern into all the heads. And I'm one of those people, I'm a pattern person. Like, I get a pattern for a head that I know works and I put it in my head. That's just it. That's, I have a set pattern that I use. It's very simple. Or actually, it's gotten more complicated as techniques have intensified. But for the most part, I can get almost any head with the right offset, that middle offset, to throw the way I wanted it to. And I don't... That's actually not true. I'm kind of... My argument is that that's no longer true. Because the consistency and the weave and how these... The diamond size of all these companies is so vastly different now that it's impossible to have a universal truth. And that is bothersome to me. Like, it's really bothersome and really annoying. And I hashtag performance mesh is a lie. It's not a lie. It's just... The brand loyalty that you see for heads is now trumped by the brand loyalty to patterns and mesh. And I think that's like a dangerous slope that we're sliding down because of this point. The price. Why am I trying all these different meshes for $20 a pop when I know in my mind and in my experience as a player and a stringer, I can get hard mesh to react the same way as this performance mesh. It just takes way longer to get there. Okay? It's like I liken it to the culture of immediacy, right? Where I can string ahead with, and I don't mean to like single out a certain brand, I can string ahead with Hero Mesh, String King 3S, or, you know, Thrown Fiber, and I will vary the pattern a little bit, but I'll get it ready to throw right away, and it will not throw the same for each mesh, right? You can get that, but it takes less right, you work.
Have to mix up the patterns a little bit.
Right, but like, there's just this whole culture of immediacy. I'm going to spend so much on the mesh for a head that people are always looking back at, and I'm going to tie this into my larger point, which is like the kids are stringing and restringing their sticks like once every 2 weeks now. And the material cost for that is thousands of percent higher than it was earlier. And heads are the same price. So back in the day, people would do that with heads. So if you restring a stick 3 times in a month, you're using a different piece of mesh each time, you're spending at least $20, not counting new shooters and new sidewall and new top string and new bottom string, right?
Wait, just on the mesh. That.
What?
That's kind of news to me. There are kids who do that?
Yeah, that's a big part of lacrosse right now. That's how these companies are like, everyone's like, oh, where did ECD come from? Where did Throne come from? Where did String King come from? It came from all these kids restringing and stringing their sticks and thinking their stick has more to do with how they're playing than how they're playing.
My experience coaching was always the opposite, and I'd have to tell kids they were allowed to come to practice tomorrow unless their stick was restrung because it was so terrible.
Right. And now kids are, I had a bad practice, I'm going to restring my stick.
And restring it for them.
Right. Well, when I was a coach, I did that. I like wouldn't let kids string their sticks. But we've already covered that before. My point is, like, this whole performance mesh movement is sort of at the heart of why head sales are down. See what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. And I think, to a certain extent, I think the thing that you missed in sort of the reason for it is, I would say, the rise of the Instagram stringer.
Oh, God, yeah. The Cedars. I call them the Cedars.
Because that's something that I always blows people's minds when I am, like, you know, like, when I was in high school, like, there was, like, one kid on the team who could string sticks, and everybody gave their head to him to string because no one else knew how. You're like, well, why don't you just go on YouTube and learn how to string yourself? It's like, because I played in high school before YouTube existed.
Yes.
Not to mention before, like, Greg from East Coast Dives was putting up stringing videos to teach you how to string. Like, that didn't happen until even later. Like,
right.
YouTube as a website didn't exist. That's why that didn't happen. And everybody, I think you sort of, to a certain extent, had the same thing. People like, oh, you know, I need a new stick. My head, you know, it's terrible. This one's terrible. And they would go out and buy a new head.
Right.
And no, I think you're right that now people are less likely to do that and instead just spend a bunch of money getting their sticks restrung.
Yep. There's my second troll job of the podcast. Performance mesh guys, you're why all the big companies don't sell heads. Congratulations.
And also, the other thing to point out, too, is that part of the reason people didn't used to do that with hard mesh was because it took so long to break it in.
Yeah.
Like, getting a new head was like a... Getting your stick restrung was like, oh, like, people used to put off doing it for as long as possible.
Oh, yeah. Like, and you would blow... There's the other thing, too, is, like, you would blow a sidewall before the mesh would rip. And now, yes. A lot of this performance mesh is sacrificing feel for durability. Or durability for feel, you know, like your mesh is, oh, it feels great. I can feel the ball every time. And then, oh, someone stepped on my stick and now my mesh is completely blown apart. And that would never happen with hard mesh, ever. Did you ever see a piece of hard mesh rip on the mesh? Ever. Unless it was a bottom string or a sidewall. I'm talking middle of the pocket.
I'm trying to think of an instance. I mean,
I'm sure it's happened, but it happens far more frequently with performance mesh
you're right. Like, people used to blow out sidewalls. That was like a somewhat regular.
Right. And now people don't blow out sidewalls. They blow out the entire piece of mesh. And the mesh costs more than the sidewall. You know? It just makes you think. I don't know. I know I have a lot of like friends in these performance mesh companies, and like they're all going to be so mad at me if they listen to this. But I mean, you got to think about like
we keep it real. We're keeping it 100.
Yeah, I mean, on this podcast. People are really going to be mad, and that's fine. But think about it, right? And I'm sure the big companies already know that, and that's why they're mad and started creating their own mesh. Right? It's like, well, fine. Fine, we'll go to China, we'll get these guys to make this for us, and we'll say it does this, and then can we say coaxial? Let's put coaxial in here. Okay. Can we say flex point? Okay, let's say that. You know, it's a lot of, like, mumbo-jumbo to, like, describe a weave, and the performance guys already have the market. You can't get it back. You can't have it. You know? But, anyway, that was my gear rant. Sorry. Sorry, guys. I have a better one on, and we're going to do this later in the next podcast. We're going to create our favorite stick with pieces of other sticks that we've used that we really liked. And I think that's a fairly worthwhile exercise. I think a lot of companies are always trying to make that perfect stick, but the individual customization of lacrosse kind of makes that tough to do per person. But if you gave me like an ability to make my own stick just for me, every lacrosse player could do that. And I think that's kind of a worthwhile pursuit. But,
Hey, that's where we're going. 3D printed heads. Just print out a new one at home. There you go. That'll be the day.
Yeah.
Spend 20 bucks on new mesh and print the head out at home for free.
Oh my God. That's so scary. The mesh will probably be 50 bucks by then though.
So the next topic we're going to talk about, there's a couple of, none of them huge, but a couple of minor MLL news,
right,
that we want to get your take on. So first, I think probably the most important one, the JoJo Marasco trade,
right,
from the Lizards. Joe Spallina dealt him to Rochester for a first round pick.
It's the last stand in Rochester, man. This is it. I know we like said they were going to move and all that stuff, man. Everyone in Rochester affiliated with that organization knows that this is the last stand. I think it's going to be the last season in Rochester. I can't believe they actually stayed, to be honest with you. And this trade is indicative of that. So one of the things the Rattlers clearly missed last season was Dave Lawson, who they traded to the Lizards. And the problem with JoJo last year is that when Dave Lawson came in, he took a lot of the space on the field that JoJo occupies, and they played on the same line several times, like many times. But I would say that Lawson got the majority of the runs from the places he likes to be, and JoJo likes to be in those similar places.
That's why Lawson scored more points.
Right. And I mean
it's fair. That wasn't a case. If we're going back to our stats discussion, that was more about opportunity than ability.
Right. And you know, a coach has to make a decision on, can this guy get to the hoop better than this guy? And if so, if they play the same spot on the field and in the offense, the guy who can do it better gets the burn, right? Like, he gets the run. So I think this is I don't want to say addition by subtraction, but it makes the path of the Lizards clearer. Not just because they move JoJo, who had 15 points, which is a little low for him. I think he's a much better player than his point total indicated.
Yes.
They got the first rounder in return. And I don't think they're drafting anyone with this first rounder. I think they're using it to get one of the guys that is out there for player movement and pay the compensation with the pick. And I think they're acquiring several picks to do this with.
And that's one of the other things we're going to talk about. That was further evidenced today by them trading down. They had the fourth overall pick. And they dealt it to Boston for number 7 and number 14.
Right. So just because it's a first round pick, it just has to be in the first round. It doesn't have to be, you know, the value of the pick does not increase regardless of its position when it comes to compensation. So all that matters is what round it is.
That's one of the weird things that I think they need to iron out about player movement.
Oh yeah,
because how fair is it that New York, if they sign a guy, just picked up a free second round pick because they're using a pick to sign a guy in player movement?
Sure. I mean, you're gaming the system. That's what good GMs do, man. I don't know if you heard of this guy. His name is Bill Belichick. Maybe you heard of him.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I'm not. I'm not disputing. It's the right thing to do. I'm just saying. I think that is that's a problem that I think they would be smart to fix in the future.
Right. Right. So several of the, you know, Rochester players are still out there, not signed with Rochester. I mean, you got Joel White would make a huge impact on the Lizards because they haven't lost Hartzell yet, but he filed for player movement. They can re-sign him at no cost to them.
Wasn't that, though, a case of – that was the reverse – he was the reverse Rochester guy.
Right, sure. No, I mean, I'm just saying, for an example –
he was filing for player movement so that he could join the Rattlers in Dallas.
Right.
That's not
really relevant to the point. The point I'm making is that
right,
there's a spot if they don't re-sign him. And that's a guy they would go after.
That would be a slight upgrade for them, wouldn't it?
I think it would be a massive upgrade in terms of on-ball coverage, not so much and versatility, not so much player value. I just think that Joel White does totally different things than Kyle Hartzell does at this point in his career. He's younger. He's a little more, I would say he's a more accomplished one-on-one defender. I think Hartzell is a much better shooter for sure, and a transition threat, two-point threat, more so than White could ever be at this point. But I think White is more versatile. And that's what the Lizards need, right? I mean, that's really why they lost in the semifinals. They had no versatility. They had nobody. Their defense was old. Their defense was penalty heavy. And, you know, they got exposed by Denver's young legs in the semifinal. And even going up to that, they played teams and lost to, like, you know, Charlotte, Florida. I mean, they get exposed. Their defense got exposed in the six by athleticism. So them going for a more athletic pole makes sense. Mike Manley's out there as well. They could try and sign him. If they were really kind of – I mean, there's two guys here that are way off the radar if you're not paying attention, but – there's one guy out there that hasn't signed with the team yet that I think everybody in the league wants. Do you know who it is?
Greg Gerentlian.
No.
But he's not going anywhere other than New York, but he's still unsigned, I believe.
That's true. But okay. Do you know I'll give you a hint. It's an offensive player. Do you know who it is?
Oh, Joe Walters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. JW1. It's a coveted prospect. I mean, people are going to be sending him gift baskets all the way through Christmas and New Year's. Till he signs. And I think, you know, we talk about the Lizards, you know, the in vogue thing in sports is to make the super team. If you add Joe Walters to that Lizards lineup, that's a super team.
Oh, and also, that'd be the other thing, too, is adding him doesn't make any sense if you have Marasco and Lawson.
Right.
You don't need three lefty midfielders.
Right. I mean, also, you know, Walters probably, I mean, he's still in great shape, but, I mean, he is – getting older and playing him at attack is definitely an option.
That's true.
Especially on that team, even though Gibson's kind of there in that role, Gibson's not a creator. You know, Walters is a creator from any place on the field and much more dangerous with the ball in his stick as opposed to an off-ball player. You can kind of move an off-ball guy around a little bit easier than you can like a guy that is ball dominant.
But I mean, I'd say the bigger problem would be for them you'd have to have two lefties on the fast break. You have to run left-handed fast breaks because I think Joe Walters is very, very adamant about the fact that he's never going to put his stick in his right hand.
Right. I mean, Gibson will too, though. I mean, that's the thing about Gibson. He's a little more versatile than people give him credit for. He can.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. You run maybe then like a V break where you run Gibson down low as the flex guy on either side and keep Pinnell and Walters on their strong-handed sides.
I mean, is that the best attack? I mean, they also have – I think they still have Westervelt if they brought him in on the right.
That's true. They have so many guys. I don't know.
And they'll have to make some decisions coming up. But I think, you know, that's kind of the nature of that trade. Getting that second rounder, I mean, there's some second round guys that are out there. I just don't think it's a – they might actually use that. I mean, they would leverage that to get another one, but – if the Lizards have all these number one picks, it's pretty obvious what they're doing, right? I mean, I had a conversation before we jumped on this podcast with someone that was like, hey, are you shading the Lizards with this statement that the Lizards are going to burn this pick on a player movement? And my argument is, how am I shading a team by just saying what you're going to do and what makes sense for what you're going to do and get you the best player for your team possible? How's that shading? I'm curious. Right?
It depends on how you interpret burn.
But I mean, did you saw the tweet. Did you think that was burn on the Lizards? I didn't think it was.
No, I think, like, you just meant, like, burn isn't getting rid of.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's, or like spend. It's like a, it's like, you know, get some money to burn.
Yeah.
Like you have some money. That you're going to spend, or that you are okay spending.
Yes. The other point of news that we wanted to touch on real quick, Stan Ross no longer an MLO coach, resigned from the launch.
Resigned as the Florida launch coach.
Yeah, resigned as the Florida launch coach. I never had a great relationship with Stan Ross, so like I'm not crying about it. But I think the hot take here is the guy in line for that job is, let's see, who else is in Florida and is an assistant coach and might have the time to coach an MLL team?
Oh, he's was pretty good in the MLL too.
Pretty good. MVP 2 years ago. Who is that? Oh, it's KZ Powell. So don't be shocked if KZ Powell is a head coach in the MLL next year. That's all I'm saying. It might not happen. They might look elsewhere, but that's a pretty, not a big logical jump to make that he's a target.
It is. It's a place where you don't have a lot of coaching talent in the immediate proximity. Different than like the Bayhawks, where you know, or the Lizards, where you have sort of there's a bunch of potential candidates in the immediate area.
Well, not to be too, what's the word for this? Gentrified, but
negative.
Isn't Florida full of like retired lacrosse coaches? There's got to be somebody.
Oh, that's a good point. You know? Maybe somebody you haven't even thought of who's like, you know, 66 or something who moved down to Florida.
Sure.
After they retired.
Yeah.
And I mean, the MLL, it's a coach in the MLL. You only have practice, like, you know, you don't have to work every day.
No, that's true. You work basically 3 days a week and then some personnel stuff in between. You can hire a guy to do that for you. But I think, you know, the biggest problem with the launch is that everybody is from somewhere else and they could never fly guys in. They could never have practice. And it's not a formula for winning when you can't practice with each other and you can't form a team identity. And that was their biggest problem last year. It's their biggest problem for the last 2 years. They have all this talent and they just can't get it to interlock. They're pushing square pegs through round holes the whole time, just hammering them in, trying to get them to work. You know, and it becomes less of a, you know, if you can't win, why are you playing kind of mentality? And that's, you know, Florida guys will dispute that mentality exists, but I know it's down there. I know that's true. So if you get a coach in there that can, you know, get guys to rally and get guys to believe in the fact that we're so talented, like we can win in this league. That's everything. I don't know who that guy is. I don't know if it's KZ Powell. I don't know if it's someone else. But I think that kind of problem.
It could be me. Hire me.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I got the news from the PR guy down there, and I was like, hey, I'm available. Like,
yes,
I'm available.
Hire us. Hire us. We'll tape podcasts at before and after practices.
Yeah, people definitely have an opinion, that's for sure. I mean, obviously, that's never going to happen, but...
We couldn't talk about the MLL, but we could talk about college. We could coach an MLL team and talk about college lacrosse, couldn't we?
I think so. We just can't. Well, actually, you can coach both, so it doesn't really matter. But hey, going on kind of like the fights, right? Like the kind of like people have the opinion of you or I, kind of a point we had earlier. You've been getting into some scraps lately. You've been getting into some scuffles. You've been getting into some scuffles. You've been getting into some scuffles on Twitter lately.
Oh, well, I don't want to talk before. Rather than talking about that, I would rather talk about, I guess it was sort of one of the ones I was in a scuffle today, but was talking with people about the Wall Street Journal article about Amazon's looking to add sports streaming. And they mentioned specifically that lacrosse would be a great fit.
Yes. What did you think about that? What did you... You thought they meant MLL, but I think they mean NLL.
Oh, no. I didn't think... I agree. I would 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
That I think in terms of probability of happening, it's definitely the NLL. I think a lot of my followers were thinking the MLL and what a great fit it would be for the MLL.
Sure.
But I just think... I think that given where they're at with LSN, there's virtually no chance that deal would ever happen.
Unless they were grossly overpaid for the rights and LSN dissolved, which is not going to happen for at least a couple more years, if it were to happen at all.
Right, that I think that basically going into LSN, I don't think there's anybody who was involved with that that thought that it was going to be sort of a success during year one. That I think they're in it for the long haul. And it's definitely going to get a 2-3 year run to see if they can make it work. I think that almost this past year was the trial run, so they kind of know what they're doing going into year two. And that's really, you're going to see, what it's capable of in the second year of covering the MLL.
Yeah, and I think they learned some lessons. And, I look at LSN not as a network. Like, they're positioning themselves as kind of a network or a channel. I see them as a startup. I see them as basically a company startup. And one of the growing pains with startups is, what are we getting in return for the effort we're putting forth? And I think LSN is learning a lot of lessons with that. And the thing that you learn when you're in a startup or you're working with a company that's new is sometimes you're not the right fit, and you'll see some attrition, I think, this year. Not just in front of the camera, but like kind of behind the camera with LSN. And I think that'll improve the talent that they have. Not that they have bad talent now, but I think more talent is coming and they have a better chance. But, that being said, their bread and butter is the MLL and the MLL rights, since the MLL basically kind of put up all the money to form them. That's why they're not going to Amazon. I mean, that's just like logic.
They're run by the MLL. If you look at LSN's like corporate filings, they're identical to the MLL's. It has Dave Rose's name on them and the same address and everything.
Right. Right. And I'm still breaking trades on your face, by the way. Sorry, I just wanted to put that in there. Still breaking trades.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think the in order for like any kind of like sort of Amazon deal or something like that to happen, I think the MLL would basically have to throw away all of their investment into LSN, because to Amazon it has no value, because the whole point of Amazon wanting the rights to a pro lacrosse league is to stream it through their platform,
right, and create content.
Right, they don't necessarily have a need. They don't have a need for sort of an independent content distribution network like LSN. And the problem is the MLL, they've sunk all of the money they have and investment into it now, and they really haven't expected a payoff yet. And so why would they throw it all away before they gave it an opportunity to see if there would be a potential payoff for the investment?
Right, which is why NLL is the more, logical move here. And, I mean, who picked up NLL streaming? Was it Fox last year in the U.S.?
I think that's more – I don't necessarily know that anybody picked it up so much as that was – I think Fox Sports Go was the streaming, distributor that they ended up going – that they went with.
Right.
But I'm not sure. I don't know the finances of that deal in terms of who was exchanging money. But my guess would be to say that I would be surprised if it was that Fox Sports was paying for that content.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, like, if you could find NLL streaming in the U.S., that's where you would find it.
There were occasionally the games that were on TSN in Canada, I think, were streamed through ESPN3 in the U.S.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
And there were some of them that were available, like, that were local. Like, I think, Altitude Sports showed the Mammoth games in Denver.
Right. Right. So it's more just having the platform, not the exclusivity, which is what Amazon wants. They want the exclusivity.
Right. And I think that, and also, the other thing I was going to say, I think if Amazon was going to spend money purchasing rights, really probably the options they would want to look into would be college lacrosse.
We talked about this before, though. What all those deals are tied up with conferences and other sports on TV in America, at least. Like, how hard is it to get a universal streaming license? It's got to be difficult.
Right, but you don't No, that's definitely true. But there are potential. I think there are still options. There are still options for certain. It wouldn't be like all of the ACC games would all of a sudden be on Amazon. But if they were trying to look into the sort of field lacrosse market, I think like, I guess I'm not sure that there's a reason to go with the MLL over like the CAA conference or something from college lacrosse.
Sure. Sure. You're getting a more comprehensive package. You're getting a technically. I mean, you're kind of getting a more exciting product to this neutral fan, right?
Oh yeah, and I think that the thing too that's nice about Amazon is they're not necessarily in to them. Lacrosse doesn't have to be the reason that you sign up for Amazon Prime. It doesn't have to be the reason. It just has to be. It can just be one of many reasons that it's. I mean, it's more like ESPN or cable in that way, rather than LSN, where LSN needs you to pay the money just for lacrosse games.
Right.
But it could be that, you know, someone in your house wants Amazon Prime for lacrosse. Somebody else likes the TV shows that they have. Somebody else likes the free shipping, and then sort of collectively, it makes the decision to get Amazon Prime worthwhile.
Right. It's an acquisition of an asset of a group of people, which makes sense.
Right.
Tied to a streaming platform right now.
Right. They don't necessarily need to make like a huge splash with it.
I mean, it is kind of a splash though, isn't it? I mean, for us it is, for the lacrosse world it is, just not for them.
Right. Well, I just mean like I don't the number of people that would sign up for Amazon Prime because like Towson games are going to be streaming on it is going to be relatively small.
Right.
But I think the bigger thing would be that if you knew that there were Towson games streaming on Amazon Prime and you were either on the fence about getting it or you already had it, it would give you a reason to go to Amazon streaming services and maybe start using it. If you already were an Amazon Prime subscriber, or if you were on the fence about it, it would be an extra reason for you to sign up or renew your subscription or something along those lines.
Oh, so it's like a D3 letter of intent signing. See what I did there?
Do you want to get into this?
No,
we don't
have time. So we're going to wrap this up. My name is Kyle Devitt. I am the gear and lifestyle editor at Inside Lacrosse. You can follow me on Twitter at the Kyle Devitt and on Instagram at the Kyle Devitt.
And I am Patrick McEwen, aka the Lacrosse Film Room guy. You can follow me on Twitter and Snapchat at Lax Film Room and at Lacrosse Film Room on Instagram and YouTube. Thanks for listening. We will be back sometime soon, hopefully next week.